Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hello, welcome to PSR, People Speaking Rail. We are those people. I'm Mike Bowden-Distel, joined with Joanna Marsh. This is the Freightwave show. We talk about the railroad industry. And Joanna, I think we should just pick up where we left off last week. We sort of alluded to that we would talk about your article on Progress Rail trying to get a court to order Wabtec to sell GE Transportation. They just bought GE Transportation. Why would they... Why would Progress Rail want them to sell?
Yeah. So Wabtec bought GE Transportation. Well, it finalized. The transaction finalized in 2019. I think it was around February or so, sometime in the first half of the year anyway. And Progress Rail is seeking to, is asking the courts for Wabtec to compel Wabtec to divest of GE Transportation because of sort of competition concerns, or sort of saying that Wabtec is trying to create a monopoly in terms of like having that software that helps with operations. And so Progress Rail is saying, hey, we still have our products as well, and also the locomotives part. I'm sorry, the locomotives part as well. Obviously, Wabtec produces locomotives and so does Progress Rail. And there's a push for lower emissions locomotives, especially, in places like California, where they're actually pushing for zero emission locomotives. And so, you have, those two companies in the supply space for locomotives. Progress Rail feels like Wabtec is kind of been not only just dominating it, but like making its software kind of incompatible with Progress Rail systems. And so so that's the reason why, yeah, that they're seeking to compel the courts compel Wabtec to divest. So
yeah, I followed this one when I was a stock analyst, and that came to an end about 2019. And it was probably the one stock that I got the most calls on. I mean, all of those, I mean, even before the GE Transportation deal, it's one that, people liked because of the concentration. Part of it was because of the concentration in the marketplace, where for most of the products that Wabtec makes, and for anyone who doesn't know what Wabtec is, they make components in all manner of locomotives, rail cars, even transit buses all over the world. And they had refurbished, repaired old locomotives even before the GE Transportation deal. GE Transportation deal got them to be an OEM manufacturer. And you see this, nice looking stock chart, up and to the right. It was kind of a screaming buy during that sell-off of the pandemic. Basically, the pandemic hit, stock went from $80 to $40 because no one thought anyone was going to buy a locomotive again or a rail car again. And that steadily improved. And it's off a little bit from its high, but the whole stock market's off from its high, now trading at, 106. It is about 17 and a half times forward earnings, which is a lot for an industrial. And really one of the features of the company is most of the products that they make, sometimes there's only one, maybe two competitors for those. And then, the locomotives that we're discussing here, you mentioned in your article, Wabtec has sold about 75% of the active diesel locomotives in North America, and then their market share is about 90% if you just look at the long haul freight locomotives that comply with the Tier 4 emission standards. And so you almost have a couple of different kind of competing interests here, where the governments want the locomotives to be more and more efficient in terms of not having a lot of emissions, but the more they do that, the more it gets to be dominated by one player was sort of a great feat to comply with those, you know, regulatory claims, regulatory issues on the emission side. So it is very concentrated. And I think what you talk about in your articles is the tying of these products together, where if you have the GE makes a lot of the software that makes it optimal to drive, you know, trains for the greatest amount of fuel efficiency. I guess if those only work with GE locomotives, that violates some rules according to Progress Rail. But another thing that comes up with this company, and I don't know if this is part of their Progress Rail's complaint or not, is that Wabtec really makes most of its margin on the aftermarket. So, just like a lot of, companies that manufacture equipment and then also service the equipment or supply parts that service, the equipment when certain parts break down, they make a better margin on the aftermarket components. And, sometimes it can be, difficult to use aftermarket componentry that's from a different, company. You see things, that happen with industries like tractors. So, that could potentially be an issue, also. And then you mentioned that Progress Rail is alleging that there's false claims that the company made in investor presentations suggesting that they're really the market in new locomotives. Almost seems like that would be more of an SEC issue than that anything. But definitely interesting article. Anything else stand out to you from on this topic?
Yeah. Actually, kind of what you mentioned. I think, in addition to divesting GE Transportation, Progress Rail is saying that they that Wabtec has violated two interoperability agreements, and one of them is, as you mentioned, sort of the aftermarket product. I think Trip Optimizer actually, and how it doesn't completely, according to the agreement, it should coordinate his systems, with Progress Rail systems, but doesn't quite do that, according to the legal briefing. So that is one operability agreement that they feel is kind of in violation. It'll be interesting to see how it unfolds. I haven't checked the filing since last week, so I'm not sure if Wabtec has replied yet. I had asked them about, the CFO's remarks, of course they deferred to the statement, and I think, that's also partially because I think anything that they say now, to the press is sort of potential fodder for, part of the lawsuit. So
yeah, so really interesting one to watch. Want to move on to the next story. Cincinnati voters are going to decide on whether to sell the line to Norfolk Southern that goes through Cincinnati. So usually at FreightWaves, when we're talking about Cincinnati, it's Clarissa talking about all the goings on at Total Quality Logistics, which she seems to be a focus of hers oftentimes. But this time we're presenting Cincinnati in maybe a different light. What are sort of the arguments on both sides here? I mean, this is a unique situation. These cities don't usually own the rail lines. It's by and large, it's owned by the Class I railroads. They were gifted that that land as part of the agreement, sort of in exchange for the common carrier obligation. But what are sort of the arguments on both sides of this?
Sure. So the city of Cincinnati owns the land underneath the track, but I think it's like an over 200-mile stretch from Cincinnati to Chattanooga. But Norfolk Southern has actually always operated and maintained that line. I can't speak today, through its subsidiary, and Norfolk Southern leases the line from the city. So the city has decided, let's think about selling this line to NS and use the profits from that essentially to fund infrastructure improvements in the city, kind of put it in a trust fund. So, it always have, that money banked for infrastructure improvements. And this idea is coming up for a vote on November. So Cincinnati citizens must approve for this to happen. If it does happen, then NS will, take ownership of the whole line probably sometime the first half of next year. If it doesn't happen, then the lease will continue through 2016, and then we'll probably, or I said 2016, didn't I? I'm 2026. My mind is like not here today. 2026, it's probable that the lease will, they'll renew the lease after that. But who's to say? The two sides. So the city is really pushing for to sell the line. I actually just saw a headline, I think, this morning about the Cincinnati mayor and some other city officials too, airing some commercials or some spots, public spots, saying, talking about this potential arrangement. There is some vocal local opposition. I'm not sure how much the local opposition represents the citizens overall, but the vocal opposition primarily kind of the argument kind of falls in two categories. One is that the city should be asking more money from Norfolk Southern. Maybe it's worth more than what it is. I think, and I don't know if this is true or not, they're kind of talking about, more money was quoted before. So they're kind of not crazy about the $1.6 billion mark. and the other one, I think, is just the idea of owning this railroad asset, because it's a unique situation. And Norfolk Southern still is, is still has that tarnished, still has, what happened with East Palestine.
Yeah.
So, there's also that concern as well, even though they are actually still operating fine. So you have the local sense concern, and also Railroad Workers United, which is an inter-union group, has kind of also come in about the public ownership of the railroads, which is kind of what they advocate for in general. It'll be interesting to see exactly what happens. I actually did talk about this on Freight Waves Now, earlier this week. And, when I was speaking then, I have forgotten, this is an off election year as well. So it'll be interesting to see who exactly comes out to vote. Whether, the opposition will be able to sort of rally people to sort of, vote against it, or if you'll have, the people who normally come out, plus other people who might not otherwise come out during a non-presidential election year, will they come out too? I don't know. So it's a little hard to say what will happen. And it's interesting because actually Norfolk Southern hasn't, they've been careful in how, what they measure. I wasn't careful. They've been measured in what they, the sort of their comments on whether the sale will happen or not. But they've been kind of saying, oh, we'll see what happens. So
yeah, it's too bad Jerry Springer isn't still around. We could get a quote from him.
Yeah.
But I think if I was a resident of Cincinnati, I'd probably vote to sell it if it means you don't have to raise my taxes anymore. I'll move on to this next one. I'll handle this one. This is the intermodal contract rates come under pressure. This is one chart that really stands out from Sonar. And so what we're looking at here is intermodal contract rates, sort of excluding fuel surcharges. So these are domestic intermodal contract rates. They're largely in lanes that are competitive with the highway. And if you're not familiar with our Sonar charts on a year-over-year basis, these seasonality charts, each of those lines represents a year. So 2023 is that white line, which has been downward sloping, really showing intermodal rates coming under a lot of pressure after double-digit rate increases from 2020 to 2021, and then again from 2021 to 2022. These going back the other way. We sort of look at an average of the last few weeks and look at what that is on a year-over-year basis, and I get down about 17% year-over-year. And what's interesting is, we talked to a lot of companies that ship intermodally as well as truckload. I mean, a lot of times just from the very same facilities that they're shipping both intermodal and truckload, and it just depends on how time sensitive something is to a large extent, and how good rail service is which mode they'll use. And they just put out a big amount of freight out to bid, and they were getting price reductions, contract rate declines that were even more severe than what we're showing on this chart, down more like 30%. And the other nuance there is that there was more pressure on domestic intermodal contracts for the asset-based carriers as opposed to the non-asset-based carriers. And the reason for that is the asset-based carriers, they've taken delivery of lots of containers here recently. They want to keep those containers utilized and turned. The non-asset-based carriers don't have the same degree of pressure and would have to get a container from somewhere when they arrange an intermodal load. So really intermodal, rates coming under a lot of pressure. We'll see, how this sort of manifests itself when the companies report earnings starting in mid-October. Usually starts out with J.B. Hunt, followed by Class 1 Railroads. I'm going to hear from Hub Group a little bit later, but kind of one of many, sort of headwinds from that we're seeing in the rail industry. Did hear from Union Pacific on that recent analyst meeting that they were essentially talking down numbers in the third quarter, not just because volume was disappointing, but also because there were lots of cost headwinds and I think just a lot going on there. Also get a lot of questions on what's happening with motor vehicle volume in light of the strike, the United Auto Workers strike. And, volume comes out every Wednesday in the AAR. We get it into our system kind of very early on Thursday morning, and you have a couple of charts on motor vehicle shipments. And what's interesting is, really haven't seen as of this most recent week, a big fall off in motor vehicle shipments outbound from, the United States and really finished motor vehicles. That makes up 80 or 85% of what's in this data is finished motor vehicles. You see in orange how there were, almost none during the start of the pandemic. Those auto plants were shut down, that recovered. And really ever since then, auto supplies have been tight. And, right now, when you compare 2023 volume to 2022 volume, U.S. motor vehicle shipments on the railroads up 22.7% in the last week and up 14% year over year in the past 4 weeks. So if anything, there was a little bit of a surge on the railroads. So it suggests to me that there was enough finished vehicles that were nearby U.S. manufacturing plants that it didn't impair what they needed to get on the railroad immediately. Now that could, this strike persists, could fall off, rather dramatically. What's also interesting is turning this next chart on Canada, motor vehicle shipments from Canada, those have been strong. You see the white line 2023 volume there. See a little bit of a surge in the last week. And those are actually up in this week ending September 23rd, up 32.7% year over year. And in that week, up 16.7% higher than the average weekly volume year to date in 2023. So Canada does seem to be benefiting from the UAW strike, although it did seem like that volume has been strong ever since about May. Want to move on to the next story here. This is one you wrote up, Joanna, on Greenbrier orders. And Greenbrier had a huge volume of orders. They tend to announce their railcar orders that they've received during their fiscal quarter. Seems like about a month before they report those, that volume. And I'm not sure why exactly, other than, my only speculation is they do that because they don't want it to leak. And then someone speculates on the stock price and they can get in trouble that way potentially. But, a large number of orders received 15,300 orders. And this is a company that usually manufactures something like 20,000 cars in a full year. And they said they didn't have any multi-year orders in there, which sometimes you see from a big company like a GATX. They'll get a better deal. They'll have a multi-year deal with, often Trinity, another, rail car manufacturer. But said they didn't have any of that. And they said it was broad-based across a number of different rail car types. And so I guess my question is, why are they receiving so many orders when rail traffic hasn't been great? It seems like rail service has improved. So that would actually cause less demand for new equipment because you're utilizing the existing equipment efficiently. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, one of the reasons that they gave was, looking at the pending retirements of various rail cars, like the box cars, for instance. I mean, you know, they have a life, you know, a set lifespan of, you know, however many decades, and then, you know, they have to retire. I think by federal law, they have to retire those assets. And so I think, you know, there is that factor, and that's a reason that they've stated. It is an interesting number in the sense that, you know, it is higher, pretty high, and as, you know, kind of surprising that, you know, it's one of the higher numbers that they've seen in, you know, the last, I don't know, 8 to 10 years or so. Other than that, it's kind of, you know, me speculating. I don't know, you know, if it's, you know, because it is a quieter market right now, maybe that's the time to go looking for new purchases, you know, before, you know, there's a big demand for them. But that's, you know, that's just kind of normal sort of, you know, with the way economics go. But yeah, I mean, retirements for sure. I think that's something that people are looking at. But I don't know, do you have any thoughts on, you know, what might be factors or?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, those rail cars are pretty specific to the types of products that are being moved, and sort of even though overall carload traffic pretty soft in aggregate, there's still some pockets of strength there. I mean, actually, one of them has been the auto racks. You know, some of the chemical cars seem to be in demand. That seems to be a growing area overall. Those cars don't tend to last as long as some of the other car types. There's tank cars. The chemicals tend to, you know, corrode them a little bit. So I think there can be pockets of strength, even though there's excesses of other car types. Want to move on to the next topic here. This is another one that you wrote up, and it seems like this is part of a theme of companies expanding their intermodal services. And this time, you're talking about Norfolk Southern expanding domestic intermodal services in Florida. Got a chart with some palm trees there, and is that a Florida East Coast railroad? And we actually have a good sonar chart that kind of explains this in a map format, where the Florida East Coast Railroad is the one in Florida in yellow there. So it goes from Miami, just as the name of the railroad suggests. It's the Florida East Coast Railroad. It goes from Miami to Jacksonville, and then you see the purple lines are Norfolk Southern's network, and those go through. I mean, easily, you know, of course, do a lot in Atlanta, you know, do a lot in Chicago, like all the railroads do, but a lot largely sort of east west. And so you're talking about how partnering to get into more markets, both sort of in and out of Florida. And you know, one thing that strikes me is we actually have a sonar chart on domestic loaded volume from Chicago to Jacksonville and Jacksonville back to Florida. And what strikes me about this is the container count in between those. So this is loaded domestic containers. So 53-foot containers that are loaded in white is Chicago to Jacksonville. So they're southbound, 133 containers on average on a day in the last week, going back from north, Jacksonville, Chicago, about 95. So it's not one of the denser lanes, and you do makes you wonder if, you know, more partnerships like this can make that volume even denser, you know, than it is, or even take it further south into Miami. I know they move a lot of consumer goods northbound from, you know, Miami, South Florida, up through Jacksonville, that go onward, a lot of oranges as well. And then interesting, they have a kind of laundry list of steel wheel interchange, you know, points, you know, talking about Chicago, Cincinnati, Harrisburg, Kansas City, Memphis. So a lot of just real key places that could potentially see easier service in and out of Florida.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on this after writing that article?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I like the sonar charts. Those are really nice. You know, kind of when I was writing it, I was kind of looking up the past recent announcements where there have been sort of expanded intermodal service offerings. And actually, Norfolk Southern does have another one with CN, Canadian National, which will actually also start the same day that the Florida East Coast Railway partnership will start. So they're both starting on Monday. And you know, the CN slash NS partnership was kind of touting, you know, the access to the Southeast markets. And so, you know, so it's I guess, so if you think about Florida, if you want to connect those two dots together, so you have, you know, Florida on one end and Canada on the other end, and sort of, you know, what sort of potential business might flow between those two pairings. So it is an interesting combo.
Yeah, for sure. So what else are you working on for the next week that we can talk about next Thursday?
Yeah, next Thursday. Let's see. What am I working on? That's a good question. I know what I'm working on for like a week and a half from now, but the next week, let's see. Probably look at, you know, there's a potential shutdown of the federal government and whether or not that actually happens. You know, how does that affect freight rail operations? And so I hope to do that, you know, before the end of this week. So that's one piece.
For the railroad? So that shut down Amtrak? Is that what would happen for the railroad industry? Or?
No, but it's more sort of like, you know, all the agencies and how that might affect sort of like safety inspections. It does it all. I mean, you know, the same sort of similar things that you think about with like the FAA. And interesting though, I was kind of looking at a link that described all the DOT agencies and what would be essential operations and what wouldn't be. And it does, you know, affect the rails, maritime and aviation, but a lot of the sort of highway stuff is actually covered under a different funding source, the Highway Trust Fund. And so that's actually not affected. Those things are not affected by a shutdown. Don't quote me on that totally. I think that's kind of what I gleaned from looking at it for like a few minutes.
Yeah, I'm sure the Class I railroads would have no problem with the Surface Transportation Board being shut down temporarily or permanently. And on that note, that's all we have for today. Wish everyone a good day.